This is a book that we've often been reminded is the only book in the Bible that doesn't contain the name of God. Nowhere in this book is God mentioned. But God is on every page of this book. It's the kind of book you start to read it and you can't really stop reading it because every chapter is a kind of cliffhanger, and then you have to read the next one because it's a very fast-flowing story with lots of twists to the plot. And you can see the sovereign hand of God through the book in a so clear, unmistakable way that there's no need for the author to write the name of God over it. You can just see God's hand in it in every way. So the center of the story is this young lady. Her real Hebrew name is Hadassah, but she's called Esther. They changed her name, I guess, same as they did to Daniel, or in some way she had to have a double name. And I want to talk about her influences, the different influences on her life. We're going to speak of four influences. We're going to just give them all a word beginning with G. And I want to start off thinking of the influence, the good influence of her genealogy, or a genealogy. I'm not sure how you pronounce it here in Canada. So this lady's family background is given to us in chapter 2. And it clearly tells us that she is Jewish. She's a Hebrew. Her ancestors, going back a few generations, lived in the nation, lived in the land of Israel. Now, just imagine being a Jew 500 years before Christ. Being of the Jewish nation 500 years before Christ conferred upon you unspeakable privileges that no one else on planet Earth had. You're talking back to the days when nobody had Bibles, there was no communications, there were no missionaries. God was, in one sense, turning a blind eye to the nations because of their repeated rejection of him, and he's working very much with this one nation, the Jewish nation. And so Esther grew up not in total spiritual darkness like most people in the world would have done at that stage, but she grew up knowing about the covenants, knowing about the promises that God had made to her father, Abraham. She had the oracles of God, the scriptures. She would have known about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. She knew that hers was the God of Moses and of Gideon and of David and all of the great characters that she would have grown up hearing about. So she could look back at her illustrious history, and she knew that she stood on the shoulders of giants. She was a Jew. Now, what she had by natural birth, these wonderful privileges that she had by natural birth, we have those privileges by spiritual birth. Now, we're not Jews, and the covenants are not ours in the same way that they belong to the Jews. But still, just think for a moment of the influence of our genealogy. We've been born into a family. The moment we were saved, we were born into the family of God. God became our Father. And now we have a genealogy second to none. We've been born again, not of corruptible seed, but of incorruptible by the word of God. And now we, you and I, if we're saved, we are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a chosen people, a special people. Just rejoice tonight as we begin this meeting that God is your Father and Christ is your Savior and the Holy Spirit is your Comforter and you are a privileged people. The King James tells you you're a peculiar people. I know there are many peculiar Christians, but that's not what that verse means. That means that we're a special people. Now, there's nothing special about us. But because we belong to God, we are his possession. We belong to him. And we have a genealogy second to none. So it doesn't matter whether you're a member of the royal family, or what country you're from, or nobody knows your name, whatever. If you're saved, you have the inestimable privilege of having God as your father and having a unique genealogy. Well, that was what Esther had because she was a Jew. That was a good influence. But the second influence I want to talk about is not the influence of her genealogy, but the influence of her geography. And that was a bad influence. Now, most people believe that Esther's probably in her early 20s in this story. And she was born in a place called Shushan. So she wasn't, even though she was a Jew, she wasn't born in Israel. She was born in Shushan. You say, where is Shushan? Well, you've been hearing about the protests in Iran. That's where Shushan is, or was. Shushan is in southwest Iran, and it was the capital of Persia. So the Iranians speak Persian. It's a Persian culture. Their language is Farsi, and there are other dialects, but it's a Persian culture, and it goes back a long way. The king of that palace and the king of that kingdom was called Ahasuerus. If you study history, they'll call him Xerxes, but the Bible calls him Ahasuerus. And he ruled the whole of the Middle East. He ruled 120 provinces spanning all the way from India in the Far East down to Ethiopia in Africa. He was the king of the world at the time. Now, because, as we learnt, as we learnt on Saturday, because the children of Israel had been taken captive to Babylon, and her relatives were in that captivity, she ended up being born a long way from home in the city of Shushan, which is in the empire there where Babylon eventually took over. So she grew up in a pagan culture. She grew up in a pervasive, influential, idolatrous, superstitious culture. Now, if you want to place the book of Esther, if you wanted to place the book of Esther chronologically, you wouldn't go Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. You would go Ezra, Esther, Nehemiah, because the events of this book actually happened between the return of the children of Israel from Babylon to Judah under Zerubbabel in the book of Ezra, and then the later return that we dealt with under Nehemiah, coming back about 100 years later. Between those two returns, we have this story of Esther, which means when the 42,000 Jews went back in the first return under Zerubbabel, she stayed behind. You say, well, she had to, she was the queen. Well, I don't want to be too hard on Esther. Jeremiah had told them, when you go to Babylon, build houses, seek the peace of the city. But quite clearly, the Jews that had gone there when Jerusalem was destroyed had got way too comfortable. And when the chance to go back came, even though there was probably 2 or 3 million of them in Babylon, only 42,000 went back. It was a real remnant that made that trip back. They had become acclimatized to the culture of Babylon. They kind of got used to their surroundings. Yes, she was the queen, would have been difficult for her, and she'd hidden her identity, and we can see the sovereign hand of God of that. But again, without being too hard on Esther, I think she is, in some senses, a picture of a believer who has got used to her surroundings, the pagan surroundings, the worldly surroundings that she was in. And maybe some of that thinking had come into her head, some of that sort of compromise with it because you're in that, that's the water that you're swimming in. And she was slow to see the need of the hour. And she needed quite a bit of pushing and quite a bit of persuading to see things God's way. Now, that's a danger for us, isn't it? We don't live in Persia, thank the Lord for that. But we live in Canada. And the influences are not quite the same, but it's the same world system. It's the same devil that rules over that world system. And the culture around us, perhaps more than in any other previous generation since the Lord Jesus was here, has a way of creeping up on us and influencing us in our thinking, Well, we could spend all night on that, and I don't think it would be necessarily very profitable, but maybe it would be a challenge to think, what kind of convictions do I have? I don't think I'm anywhere near as keen as I was when I was a young man. Maybe got a slightly wiser head on, but I was much more conscious of the encroachment of the world. But now that we all have phones in our pockets and it's sort of 24/7, you know, you got the post once a day when I was a child. We didn't get a newspaper, we didn't have a television. The radio came on for the weather forecast and the headlines, and then my dad would say, turn it off! So that was very easy, wasn't it? Just keep the world out. But the world's inside now, and you have access to anything you want 24 hours a day, and it's much harder to just remain steady in your concept of the holiness of God, and the truth of God, and the way he'd like you to walk, and that separated walk, and the walk that pleases him, the walk that fits in with his character, to walk as he would walk, to walk as Paul would have walked. So maybe that's just a word for us to be more like a Mordecai than an Esther. So we'll get on to see how Mordecai influenced Esther in a good direction. So the influence of her genealogy, the influence of her geography. Thirdly, I want to look at the influence of her grief. Esther's father was called Abihail. You can find that in chapter 2, verse 15. We don't know her mother's name, but according to chapter 2, verse 7, her parents died when she was young. She was an orphan, effectively, from a very young age, and we read there that in chapter 2 that her cousin Mordecai took her under his wing, and basically she became his daughter. Now, it is a fact that orphanhood can often lead to higher levels of stress, higher levels of depression, higher levels of anxiety. Even presuming that Mordecai did a fantastic job of raising this girl who wasn't his daughter, the grief of losing her parents at such a young age must have had a lasting impact upon Esther. In England, they talk about an ACE, an adverse childhood experience. And the NHS, our medical service, is dealing at the cost of billions of pounds a year with the effects of adverse childhood experiences. And yet here's the wonderful thing. This woman was going to be used in the providence of God to deliver the nation from the greatest threat it had had for generations. And it was this very grief, it was this very displacement, it was this very upbringing that built into her something of the character that she needed when the time came. So we're back to what we learned yesterday. Joseph went through all his experiences so that he could eventually be the ruler of Egypt. Esther went through her displacement and her family's displacement and her grief and her difficulties. And this would actually be the making of her, not the ruining of her. We dealt with that again with Joseph. Sometimes we can become very bitter and very resentful about things that happened to us when we were children, and we're unhappy with the way our parents raised us, or we're unhappy with our background or what school we went to. And we sort of have hang-ups from earlier days. But she didn't use those experiences as stumbling stones. She used them as stepping stones. You see, do you know the difference between stepping stones and stumbling stones? We all go through adverse experiences. We all have difficulties in life. Are you going to make those stumbling stones, or are you going to turn them into stepping stones? Well, that's what Esther did. She was molded by this grief. God didn't bring her out of that grief. That grief lived with her for the rest of her life. But it taught her to trust in him. It made her the person that she needed to be. She became strong. She became resilient. She became empathetic. She was not the person she was because of her grief. She was the person she was despite her grief. And she became this, one of the most sterling characters in all of the scriptures. If you'll pardon a personal illustration, not from my life, but from my family's life, my wife has an aunt who's 95. She's still alive. And at 17, her mother and father passed away. It wouldn't happen today, but back in those days, with medicine the way it was, both her mother and father passed away. She was 17. She was the oldest of three children. She had a brother who was 15 and a younger brother, that would be my father-in-law, he was 6. And here's these two teenagers and a six-year-old left with no mother and no father and a farm to run, no welfare state. This is going back to before the war, anyway, before the Second World War. And the grief of that was totally and absolutely overwhelming. And she told me quite recently that shortly after they buried both of their parents, she went into the chicken house. She said, "I closed the door and oh, how I wailed." And that was her exact expression. "Oh, how I wailed." And she sat in that chicken house and just wailed her heart out. And after a while, she composed herself. She brought out her Bible and her eye lighted on Psalm 27. She read Psalm 27. She came across a promise from God in verse 14. "Wait on the Lord, be of good courage, and he shall strengthen thine heart. Wait, I say, on the Lord." And when she finished reading that psalm, there was a knock on the door of the chicken house. And it was her 15-year-old brother, John. And he said to her, "Come on out, Agnes. We're going to have to face this." All three of those lived, well, Uncle John has gone home to glory in his 90s. Auntie Agnes is still alive at 95. And my father-in-law is still going strong at 85. And how did they live so long? And how did they follow faithfully so long? And how did they raise families for God? And how did they go through adversities? And how did they prove to be a blessing to so many? Because that experience that they went through taught them to trust and taught them to lean and taught them God in a way that they never would have learned him anywhere else. The school of adversity produces much better students than the school of prosperity. Sad to say. We have to learn sometimes, we have to learn God sometimes in a very tough school. Well, the influence of her genealogy, the influence of her geography, the influence of her grief. I want to look at, fourthly, the influence of her guardian. So who is this man, Mordecai? Well, he's her cousin. And he's a man of incredible principle, a man of incredible faith. And the influence that he had on Esther was incalculable. In fact, even though she was the queen of the empire, unless he had been there with his influence, there never would have salvation come to the Jews. And I believe the courage that Esther showed ultimately came from the courage that Mordecai showed in his life from day to day. He stood alone. Long time before she stood alone. His absolute faith in God and his absolute faith in the power of God and his absolute faith in the power of prayer was an influence, was an example to Esther growing up there in Persia. Now, our culture would like to tell us, you know, you can do anything you want to do and just go out there and plow your own furrow, but nobody plows their own furrow. Everybody has an influence, and everybody is influenced. You might think, no one's looking up to you, but they are. You say, "I'm only 12. I guarantee you, there's someone about 6, 7, or 8 looking up to you. And when you get to 12, you're looking up to the 16-year-old. And when you get to 16, you're looking up to the 20-year-olds. And that's the way life works. Everybody is having an influence. We might not realize it, but we are either inspiring others to live for God by the way we live, or we're perhaps providing ready excuses for others to backslide and drift away from things, because actions speak louder than words. So let me just challenge you tonight before we get into the meat of the story here. What kind of influence are you having? Not necessarily by coming up here and saying anything. What kind of influence are you having? When people think of you, are they inspired? Are they led in right paths? Do you carry their respect, or do they look at you and think, well, he says one thing and does something entirely different? Because if that's what we are like as elders or families or parents, we needn't wonder. Now, we've no guarantee that just because we set a good example, people will follow it. But we certainly can't hope to do much if we set a bad example. Now, Ben Sutton used to tell the story of a man heading off to the pub. And it was snowing. And he's going through the snow to the pub. And he hears a voice behind him, a six-year-old son. Daddy, I'm following you! And the little six-year-old was putting his feet in the big feet of his dad. That's where our kids put their feet. They put their feet into our feet and they follow us. I think it was a poet who said, there are little eyes upon you and they're watching night and day. There are little ears that take in everything you say. And little hands all eager to do everything you do. And a little boy who's dreaming of the day he'll be like you. You're the little fellow's hero. You're the wisest of the wise. And in his little mind about you, no suspicions ever rise. He believes in you devoutly, holds at all you say and do. He will say and do in your way when he's grown up like you. There's a wide-eyed little fellow who believes you're always right. His ears are always open, and he watches day and night. You are setting an example every day in all you do for the little boy who's waiting to grow up to be like you. So we needn't fool ourselves, brothers and sisters. We've all done it. There's no point fighting like cat and dog at home and then coming to the meeting and pretending we're angels and seraphs. It won't work. There's no point us spending all our time investing in this world's goods and gadgets and holidays and making it very clear to our children that that's really what life's all about. Don't be surprised if they grow up totally materialistic without an interest in the things of God, because example is infectious. Imagine it's a Wednesday night, it's midweek meeting. Well, you know, it's always a struggle to get to the midweek meeting. We're all busy, and sometimes we have to just charge home from work and grab a coffee at Timmy's on the way, and you know, sometimes you wonder, is it really even wise to go? As soon as I sit down, I'll fall asleep. I'm exhausted. Well, there are times when perhaps it is wise to take the odd night off and just go to bed early if you're not feeling up to it. But if Wednesday night comes round and pretty much every week the kids are looking at Dad and he's sort of looking at his watch and his wife's sort of standing there as if, well, are we going or are we not going? And Daddy sort of says, well, you know, I've had a busy week and tomorrow I've got to get up early. And I think we went, did we go last week? Or maybe we went the week before, but we have been recently, so, you know, we're in relatively good standing, and I think we'll just give it a miss. So little Charlie's in the corner, little Charlie's only 10. He's just, you know, what was it Robert McElwain used to say? Little pigs have got big ears. And little Charlie, he's listening to this. So the meeting's not going to be gone to, so sit down on the couch, pick up the remote, start flicking through the channels, and there's a hockey game on. Now, if I was in England, I'd be talking about football now, but over here I've discovered it's hockey. And his favourite team is playing. And before long, this tired daddy, who wasn't fit to go to the meeting, suddenly he's all getting excited, and he's sitting on the edge of the seat, and he's shouting at the screen, and he's cheering, and he's yelling at the referee, and he's getting all excited, and he's perspiring, and he's running out in the break and coming back in case he misses anything. You know, little Charlie's watching. You know what Charlie's just learned? He said, "What do you mean? I've not been teaching it. We homeschool, you know, we teach him from 9 in the morning to 12 o'clock, and we send him to get his piano lessons. No, but you just taught him a lesson. A much more effective one than you'll ever learn in the wee classroom. You've just taught Charlie that sport's more important than God." "Oh, but you say I don't believe that." "Don't you?" "Charlie thinks you do." Let's have a word with Charlie. "Charlie, what do you think your dad likes doing more? Going to the meeting or watching NFL?" "NFL." Charlie knows. Charlie's not stupid. Charlie's picking up all kinds of signals. And he's weighing everything up. And of course, what we allow in moderation, our children usually take to excess. These are challenging things, aren't they? Mordecai had an influence on Esther that was profound, and it was a profoundly good example. So she comes to years, and I don't know how much you know the story of Esther, but it's an absolutely amazing story. So you have this king, Ahasuerus, his wife snubs him at a grand event, and he's so upset, he sends a decree to the entire empire that, you know, she's off, I'm getting a new model. And he has a beauty pageant, and he brings in all these girls. I mean, it's just bizarre, beyond belief, that this ever happened. But he brings in all these girls, and Mordecai thinks, this girl I'm looking after is very, very beautiful. I wonder, is this going to be God's way of influencing things? So he puts her forward, and she gets swept up into this process, and she wins. So now we have this Jewish girl, the queen of the empire, and she doesn't tell her husband that she's Jewish. She keeps that a secret. Mordecai says, "Don't tell him. Don't let your family background come out." So far so good. King's got a new wife, the other one's gone, and the new wife's Jewish. Then one day the king decides that one of the people that works for him is in due for promotion. The man is called Haman, a particularly wicked man with a wicked wife. He's an Agagite, he comes from Amalek originally, and the king just promotes this man, Haman, to be basically the prime minister. And he commands everybody to bow down in front of him, something else we're not used to in our modern culture. Everybody's bowing down to Haman, and he's now top of the tree. And he was a very proud man, and he thought he'd really won the lottery because he's now the second most well-known man in the empire. Now, when he was promoted to be this top dog, everywhere he went, people would bow to him and scrape to him and kneel to him. But there was one man who refused. His name's Mordecai, the man in the story, who also had been taken, his ancestors had been taken from Jerusalem to Babylon. He's the one looking after the queen when she's younger. The queen is now in the palace. He sits in the gate of Shushan. And Haman goes by, everybody's bowing and scraping, and he's standing straight up. You might think that was a very unwise thing to do. Why didn't he just do as everybody else did? Well, he wouldn't bow to any man. He would only bow to Jehovah. He was a man of principle. And a bit like the three Hebrew slaves in Daniel, they wouldn't bow to the image, so Mordecai wouldn't bow to Haman. How do you think Haman thought of that? Well, they've just killed hundreds and hundreds of protesters in Iran. They haven't changed in 3,000 years. Haman was absolutely enraged by this man who wouldn't bow to him. And he was doing it in public. He was making it absolutely obvious. It was a snub to this Haman. Such a snub that his vindictiveness knew no bounds. And he goes to the king, who seems very easily influenced, and he says, King Ahasuerus, since becoming prime minister, I've discovered that there's a people spread all over the 120 provinces of our empire, and they're a right awkward lot. And they don't do what they're told, and they've got all their own laws, and they won't eat this, and they won't go here, and they won't do that, and they don't bow to our idols, and they're a total and absolute pest and a plague. And I think we should get rid of them, don't you? And the king, a bit like Nebuchadnezzar, whom he would he slew and whom he would he kept alive, said, yeah, sure, why not? Bring me the piece of paper and I'll sign it. And Haman brings the piece of paper for the complete destruction of the Jews, which means there'll be no Messiah, there'll be no salvation, there'll be no anything. Sign here. Now, you know that the laws of the Medes and the Persians can't be changed. And he's a Medo-Persian Empire ruler, and he signs a decree, 11 months from today, every Jew in the world will be exterminated. So the promise of Genesis 3:15 is finished. The promises to Abraham in Genesis 12 are finished. The promise to David to have someone on his throne forever is finished. It's all finished. This decree that can't be changed has been signed. Every Jew in the world is going to be exterminated 11 months from today. So Haman thinks. So Mordecai finds out about this decree. And he's so upset, he goes out into the public square, he takes his clothes off, he drapes himself in sackcloth, and he starts wailing and mourning. And weeping, so much so that someone goes running into the palace to Esther and says, your cousin's, there's something wrong with him. He's crying and screaming in public and we can't console him and he's terribly upset. So the first thing Esther does is she sends him a new set of clothes. Say, God, dress him up. I don't know what the problem is, but just give him those. It's terrible to see him wandering around in sackcloth. Here, put a nice suit on him. So they go back to Mordecai with this suit of clothes. He says, I'm not interested in a suit of clothes. Send this message back to Esther. And he pulls out a copy of the king's decree. Because they were going around, they were sending guys on horseback to every part of the empire and sort of nailing them to posts and handing them out in the streets. And here he says, here's a copy of it. Give this to Esther. This is the destruction of the Jews. Because he knows that Esther's a Jew. He's her cousin. The king doesn't know. And Esther has no idea why he's upset. So now this man goes back to Esther and says, well, the reason he's so upset is because of this. Read this. And Esther reads, every Jew in the empire is to be destroyed. Oh dear. Problem. And this is the crunch point now. What's Esther going to do now? Mordecai has been taking all the hits. He's been the most talked about man in the empire. He's despised. He's likely going to be chopped up at some point. But now it's come to my door. What am I going to do? You know, it's one thing to know when other people have convictions and the responsibility to stand by those convictions is on the elders of the assembly or on your parents or on the community in some way. Well, it's another thing when you go to work in the office in the morning, isn't it? What are you going to do? Now, it used to be quite simple to go to work in the office and say you're a Christian. Maybe there'd be other Christians there. We lived in a Christian culture. But now it's all very different, isn't it? With DEI and Pride Month and all the other stuff, rainbow lanyards and all the things that you've got to go into and go in for. And what do you do now? Now it's at your door, and it's your career, and it's your money, and it's your future, and it's your reputation. Are you going to stand? Are you going to have the wisdom to do the right thing? So Esther kind of responds third time round and says, well, Mordecai, you know as well as me, Mordecai, that you can't just go into my husband and say, good morning, you know, I think we need to do this. Husband and wife seemed to have a very strange relationship back then, certainly the king and his wife. He had to ask permission to go and see her husband. She did. And, you know, if I just go in uninvited, my dear cousin Mordecai, I could be killed. I wonder how Mordecai felt when he got that message. I rather think he was disappointed at the least. As if to say, Esther? Esther? Did you not read that piece of paper? It says every Jew in the world is going to be destroyed. And you're worrying about whether or not you're going to be killed. What about all the rest of our nation? Are you just going to protect yourself? Or are you going to stand up for the principle of the thing? See, the Christian life is not about self-preservation. Sometimes there are times that you just have to do what is right and trust in the Lord for the consequences. Now, yesterday we were thinking of Joseph and how he trusted the Lord through all those dark years. This is more like someone who trusts in the Lord on the spur of the moment. Where there's a crunch. What am I going to do? What decision am I going to make? Am I going to marry a believer or am I going to marry an unbeliever? What are you going to do? I've just been asked out by a boy at the office. He's not saved. What am I going to do? It's just been proposed by this unsaved man that I go into partnership with him and we can make a load of money. What am I going to do? And these decisions come in and you think, now if I do that, oh, ramifications in my family, ramifications in the assembly, ramifications in the future. And Esther's thinking, ugh. And so he sends back this powerful message that we read. Basically, listen, this is not a time for excuses. Esther, this is not a time to preserve yourself. This is not a time to throw every Jew under the bus and stand back and say, nothing to do with me. You've got to take a stand. And if you don't take a stand, somebody else will take a stand. Do not think you will escape. They'll get you as well. And so finally, he awakens within Esther the resolve that he had instilled into her, the example that he instilled into her, and she basically gets it. She gets the gravitas of the situation. I'm not going to look after number one. I'm not going to hide my light under a bushel. I'm not going to preserve myself. I'm not going to do risk-averse Christianity. I'm going to take a stand. Is there someone here who needs to take a stand? In some aspect of your life, is there someone here and you are right at the crossroads of some decision and there's a lot of influence pushing you that way and there's some influence pushing you that way? What way are you going to go? Are you going to take a stand? Oh, but if I take a stand? No. Are you going to take a stand? Yeah, but you don't realize if I... No, but are you going to take a stand? She says, right, okay. Get everyone together in Shushan, all the Jews, fast and pray for 3 days. I will fast and pray with my maidens. And at the end of 3 days, I'll go and see the king. Even though I haven't been invited, even though it might cost me my life, I'll go. And if I perish, I perish. There's just something so wonderful about that Rubicon that she crossed at that moment. That's the spirit we need. That's the spirit of the martyrs. You say, what's a martyr? A martyr is someone who dies for their faith. That's the spirit of the Christians that are in jail in North Korea right now. That's the spirit of people that come to Christ in countries where it's illegal. Afghanistan, Somalia, Eritrea, the Sudan, Libya, Saudi Arabia, and on and on and on it goes. Dear Christians being murdered and raped and imprisoned in Pakistan, in India. This is happening while we sit here in comfort. People willing to take a stand. It puts us all to shame, doesn't it? Here's Esther. And he says to Esther, I like what he says here. Who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? In other words, here's an existential threat to the Jewish nation. The entire seed of Abraham is going to be wiped out by an unchallengeable, unchangeable decree. And lo and behold, it just so happens that the king's wife is a Jew. As if he's saying, don't you see? You won the beauty contest for a reason. It was all in God's plan to bring you. You're there for a reason. You're there because God was anticipating this decree and he put you in place. You are the woman. It's on your lap. Take a stand and save the nation. Now, my life and your life is a whole lot smaller than Esther's. We're not kings and queens. But I wonder, are you in your office for such a time as this? I wonder, are you in your family for such a time as this? I wonder, you in your street for such a time as this? I wonder, you are you in your university, your school, your neighborhood? I wonder, are you where you are for such a time as this? I can't give the gospel to the people you live with and work with. I don't know who they are. I'm never going to meet them. I can't take a stand for Christ where you are. But you can. You didn't get that job by accident. You didn't get that house by accident. You didn't come to be where you are by accident. And if God has put you there, he's put you there for a reason. Let me ask you three questions. In taking a stand for Christ, if not here, where? If not you, who? If not now, when? See, this comes right down to where the rubber hits the road. And Esther crosses the Rubicon, and like a martyr going to the stake, she heads off to see her husband. And she approaches the king uninvited. She's literally, probably trembling. This could be the day I die. And she goes. She takes up her cross and denies herself and follows the will of God into the king's presence. And he's having a good day. He got out of bed the right side that morning. And he says, oh, Esther, come on in. And she breathes this almighty sigh of relief. And she goes in to the king. And he must have had a jolly good breakfast, because he says to her, whatever you want, you can have it to half the kingdom. What would you have said at that point? I would have said, kill Haman, change the decree, set the Jews free. But Esther wasn't like that. She's very wise. You know, taking a stand is not an easy thing. But it also needs a lot of wisdom. If you're going to take a stand in your family, in your home, in your business, in whatever, You don't just need boldness, you need wisdom. And so she says, how about you and Haman come out for dinner? Okay, when? So they set the time, and off they go to dinner with Esther. Haman thought this was great. A dinner with the king and the queen. Imagine if you got invited to Buckingham Palace for supper with Charles and Camilla. On your own! Boy, you'd think you'd made it. Be enough to go to a garden party, wouldn't it? Or even visit it and pay for it. But he's going to supper with the king and the queen. And he's as proud as a peacock. And then he goes, he swaggers in, and he sits down, and he tucks into all the delicacies of the day. And Ahasuerus says to Esther, right, now what is it you wanted again? Tell me, to the half of the kingdom you can have it. And she says, well, what I want is, come back for dinner tomorrow night. And then I'll tell you what I want. And wouldn't you believe it, Ahasuerus says, okay, fine, we'll be back tomorrow. You know, if I was him, I'd have said, oh, come on, just tell me now. What's the point in waiting till tomorrow? But the next 24 hours was one of the most extraordinary 24 hours in the history of humanity. So let's just see what happens. Haman goes hopping home to to his wife Zeresh and his family and says, you'll never believe where I've been. Where have you been now? I had tea with the king and the queen. Or supper, as you say over here. I had supper with the king and the queen. Oh, great. Yep. Yeah, I must be their favorite. And they've asked me back tomorrow. But on his way home, he saw Mordecai standing up straight, not bowing down. And he says to his wife, I've been invited to see the king and the queen. I'm their top friend. I'm basically, well, I couldn't be any closer. But all of this means nothing to me while that Haman's there. And she says, well, why don't you just build a big gallows, 75 feet high and hanging on it? Good idea! And he builds this gallows that evening, 75 feet high, gets the rope ready, and he says, well, hang him tomorrow, and then I'll go and have a feast with the king. Oh, the king goes to bed the same night, but he can't sleep. What do you do when you can't sleep? Well, he says, bring me the records of the kingdom and read them to me. So this man comes in with his big book, and he starts saying, on the 4th of April, B.C., whatever, well, they wouldn't have said B.C., would they? They'd have given him a date. We took in taxes from India of so many shekels. Right, next. And he's reading down this list, and then he says, on such and such a day, there were two men out to assassinate you, and there's a man called Mordecai found out about it. And he came, and he told us about it, and we put the assassins to death, and you didn't die, Mr. King. Oh, I've forgotten about that. What did we give to Mordecai for doing that? Nothing. Well, we need to rectify that one. Who's in the court? And just at that minute, it was early in the morning now, Haman had arrived to ask the king to hang Mordecai. So the king's woken up. Now he's got out of bed. He's had a shower and he wants to make sure Mordecai gets honoured. And Haman's coming in, proud as a peacock, wanting Mordecai to be hanged. And before Haman could make his request, the king says to Haman, Haman, tell me this. What should I do if I want to honour somebody? You know, I want to really show off this person that I'm really proud of and I'm really happy about. So Haman thinks, he must be talking about me. So he thinks up the most spectacular honour. Well, Mr. King, if you want to honour someone, I suggest you dress him up in the king's apparel and get him to ride on the king's horse and put a crown on his head and then pull him through the streets of Shushan with a man in front with a big loud voice to say, "This is what you do to the man that the king delights to honor." And everybody will bow down to him. And in the most spectacular disappointment in all of world history, Ahasuerus says to him, "What a good idea. Go and do it to Mordecai." And his jaw drops to the floor and he's downcast and he says, "Yes, your honor, I will do it straight away." And he goes home to his wife and his friends and he tells them what's happened. And they're like, "You're done for, mate. This is finished. If this is what you're doing, you won't last 24 hours. And he gets the horse and he gets the crown and he gets the coat and he dresses Mordecai up in the most humiliating spectacle the world has ever seen. And he drags him through the streets of the city saying, "This is what we do to people who are needing to be honored." And then he runs home, cries his eyes out like a baby. And his wife says, "Quick, it's time for the feast. You need to get up the road for the feast. Feast number two, get up the road." "Oh, yes." And he dresses up and he wipes his eyes and he heads up the road and he gets in. And they sit down. And the king says, "Now, Esther, enough keeping us waiting. What is it that you want?" She says, "I and my people are going to be destroyed."
"I beg your pardon?"
"I and my people are going to be destroyed." Who is out to destroy you and your people? What are you talking about? "The man who's out to destroy me and my people is this wicked Haman." You talk about the sovereignty of God. You see, when you take a stand, a wise, principled stand, the Lord won't let you down. And he turned that whole situation upside down in 24 hours. Haman hung that night on the gallows he'd built for Mordecai. The king signed over all of Haman's property to Mordecai. He then made another decree saying, "When the day comes that the Jews are to be killed, I give permission for the Jews to fight back and everybody to help them." And when it actually happened, the Jews were victorious. God put the fear of God into the people so that they wanted to help the Jews. There were 500 killed one day in Shushan and then another few thousand the next day. And the last verse of the book of Esther tells us that Mordecai got Haman's job. And he was second in command to King Ahasuerus. Esther, "If I perish, I perish." She thought she was taking a huge risk. You're not taking a huge risk when you trust in God. And he, if you take a principled stand for him, the Bible says, "Them that honor me, I will honor." And so he stood. Now, what about you? Are you going to take a stand? Take this example from Esther. The influence of her genealogy, the influence of her geography, the influence of her grief, the influence of her guardian. But you know what the greatest influence of all? The one person that's not named in the book of Esther. The influence of her God. And through trusting in God, she won the greatest victory, and it is still celebrated to this day by the Jewish nation. The Feast of Purim, it originally was called. They're still marveling at Esther and her trust in God and the example that she set and the deliverance that was wrought. And for us today, these things are written for us. May God help us to take a stand for him. So let's close with a word of prayer.